Well, another Sunday evening, another psalm, so please come with me to the psalm which we had, Psalm 11. And if you look at verse 3, it says, if the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? When the foundations crumble, when the world is collapsing around you, when everything falls apart, what can you do? David, what can you do? David is facing a crisis. The storm has hit. His world has been turned upside down. What is he to do? What am I to do? And we have four things to say this evening. So point number one, who are you listening to? Look at verses 1 to 3. In the Lord I put my trust. How can you say to my soul, flee as a bird to your mountain? For look, the wicked bend their bow. They make ready their arrow on the string, that they may shoot secretly at the upright in heart. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? Someone is saying in verse 2, David, look out. They're after you. They're going to get you. The wicked bend their bow. They make ready their arrow on the string, that they may shoot secretly at the upright in heart. David, these people, they're well armed. They're hidden. They're deadly. They could strike at any moment. So David, your life is in danger. So get out. Flee as a bird to your mountain. Now I know in the New King James Version, flee as a bird to your mountain is in inverted commas. It's in quotes. But the speaker who says to David, flee as a bird to your mountain, is also the speaker in verses 2 and 3. The whole, the latter part of verse 1, all the way down to the end of verse 3, it should all be in quotes. It's all a quote. It's what somebody's saying to him. Someone's saying to him, David, they're after you. Run for your life. Now, can we pin down David's experience to a specific episode? Well, perhaps we can. I won't be too dogmatic about this. But if you looked at the events in 1 Samuel verses 19 to 26, you'd see that this matches very well with David's experience, where David is being pursued relentlessly by King Saul. David's a fugitive. He's like a hunted animal. If you like, in the language of verse 1, he's like a little bird. And Saul has spies everywhere. And there are people lying in wait. There are ambushes. And Saul won't rest until he's closed the net on David and has his quarry. Now, if you read 1 Samuel 19 to 26, it makes great reading. It really is. There's all daring escapes and near misses. It's great reading, but actually, if you're having to live through it, it's all taking its toll on David. He must be exhausted. When did he last have a good night's sleep? And there must be that sense, as Saul won't give up his pursuit, that David, Saul's going to get you in the end. Got away with it so far, but sooner or later, David, your luck will run out. By the law of averages, Saul's going to get you. And of course, it's Saul, isn't it? He's the king. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? If the law giver is the law breaker, if the man who's got his hands on the levers of power is corrupt and vengeful and murderous, if the man who is there to ensure that justice is done is himself unjust, what can you do? Except one thing, David. Run for your life. Flee as a bird to your mountain. Find some hideout somewhere, some secure place where Saul's never going to find you. And then you can be at peace. So when everything falls apart, nothing else for it, David, but to run. Now, who's speaking in verses 1 to 3? Maybe it's David's friends. And their words are kindly meant. They want the best for David. They can't bear to see him like this. So here's the counsel of sincere, loving friends. It's, in their eyes, it's gentle counsel. It's kind counsel. They want their best for David. Come on, David, David, David. Saul's going to get you. So you've got to get away. Your life is at risk. Maybe it's his friends. Maybe the speaker is David himself. You know, sort of thing. You wake up every morning and you wake up to a voice, don't you? Yes, we all do. Whose voice is it? Well, it's your voice. C.S. Lewis wrote, "The moment you wake up each morning, all your wishes and hopes for the day rush at you like wild animals. And the first job of each morning consists of shoving them all back." Well, maybe this is the voice that David wakes up to every morning. It's his own voice. Every morning he wakes up, maybe after a restless night's sleep, and the voice is saying, "Flee as a bird to your mountain." It's his own voice speaking to him. "David, do a runner. Saul's going to get you in the end." I don't know about you, but I often have music playing in my head. It's involuntary. It plays away. And every now and again, I stop and listen to the music. And sometimes when I listen to the music, I find it's Elvis Costello singing, "And I would rather be anywhere else than here today." Because that's what I'm saying to myself. I'd rather be anywhere else than where I am now. So maybe verses 1 to 3 is the soundtrack, it's the mood music to David's life. Well, whether it's David's friends giving, as they see it, kindly advice, or whether it's David's own voice, will David listen to it? Who do we listen to? My friend, are you facing a dilemma tonight? Is your world collapsing around you? Maybe it's that bully at work. And as far as you can see, they're out to get you, and you know they're going to be there tomorrow morning. Or there's a situation in your home, or a situation in your marriage, and there seems no way out except to just run away. Or maybe to turn your back on it all and throw yourself into something else. We can all throw ourselves into something, and it's a way of getting away from the real issue. And it's our way of fleeing as a bird to the mountain. Or maybe it's that hospital visit, and there's that appointment, and you feel the net is closing around you. Or church problems. I know pastors who have just got to get away, so they go and become a pastor of another church. Or church members who just think, "Oh, I've had enough," and they're looking for a way out. And then there's the relief, isn't there, of going somewhere else, and it's new, and you can begin again. You don't have to worry about where so-and-so is sitting. No more conflict. Flee as a bird to your mountain. Run away. Who are you listening to? Well, point number two is David's response. Now, whether it's David's voice in verses 1 to 3 or the words of kind and concerned friends, does David listen? Well, look at verse 1. "In the Lord I put my trust. How can you say to my soul, flee as a bird to your mountain?" So is David listening to these voices? No. How can you say this to me? Is David listening? No. Why? Because this voice is unreliable. This voice is unbelieving. Those people who care for us most sometimes don't always give the best advice. Is David's safety the most important thing? No. Is David's peace of mind the most important thing? No. So he can't let these things, his peace of mind and his safety, dictate what he does next. He won't make an idol of himself. Do you see? What David does next won't just tell you about David. It'll tell you about David's God. It'll tell you about who he thinks is in control of the situation. Is it that God can't help? So David, you've got to take things into your own hands and do a runner. And David says, "No, no, no. I'm not going to do that because it looks like God isn't in control. God's not in charge. I'm running away. So I can't do that because, verse 1, in the Lord I put my trust. So how can you say to my soul, flee as a bird to your mountain?" So in this time of trouble, in this time of distress, I'm not running away, I'm running to him. Because he is all I need. The Lord is all I need. And he's in control, and his will is perfect, and he won't abandon me, and he'll work this for my good. And I've proved him in the past, and I believe it now. He's true to his word. In the Lord I put my trust. Now, notice David calls God the Lord. It's that word we've met many times in the Psalms, isn't it? Yahweh, that's God's name. There are some people who chant Allah Akbar. God is great. But who is the God who is great? If there's only one God, who is he? What is his name? Who is the Lord? If I'm to put my trust in him, who is he? And the Bible answers, the God who is great, the true God, the real God, who is he? He is Jesus. He is the revealer of God. He makes visible the invisible God. He reveals to us God's name. Yahweh is Jesus. We see the godness of God in the face of Jesus Christ. That is the Lord who David is trusting in. So at the wedding of Cana, the wine runs out. What does Jesus do? He turns the water into wine, 200 gallons of it. Because this is the God, it doesn't just simply, doesn't push, as it were, half a glass of water in our direction and say, there you are, take it or leave it. He is the eternally blessed God. He is the God who is full of joy. He is the God who pours the wine of his joy into our hearts to overflowing. Jesus meets a Samaritan woman by a well. Her life is empty. Her life is a desert. She's abused herself. She's been abused by others. A succession of men. But that day, Jesus gives her living water that washes her clean and satisfies her soul. Because this is the God who is maximally alive. He is the God who is the source of his own being and whose superabundant life, it fountains up and it flows out to fill the empty chambers of our souls. Who satisfies our souls with the very life of God himself. Jesus enters the temple. He finds a place of prayers, like a farmyard with all these animals waiting to be sacrificed. They shouldn't be there, but they are there. And then there are the money changers, because you can't use your money in the temple. You've got to use the temple money. But they're charging exorbitant rates. The place has become a den of thieves. It's a farmyard and a den of thieves. So with a whip of cords in his hand, and a resolute step, and eyes that are ablaze, he single-handedly drives them all from the temple, tipping over the tables, the money and animals going everywhere. Does anyone stop him? Does anyone dare? Because when we look at Jesus, we understand this is the God who burns with righteous anger against sin and against the sinner. Jesus crossing the sea with his disciples. A storm brews up. And while experienced fishermen panic, Jesus says to the storm, be quiet. And like a scolded child, the wind ceased, and we're told there was a great calm. And the disciples say to each other, who can this be? And even the wind and the waves obey him. Because this is the God who rules over all. And Jesus draws near to Jerusalem. This is the city that for generations has resisted God, that has been wicked, and despite all its privileges, all its blessings, has turned its face against God. And adding to all this will be a crowning sin. They will kill the Messiah. And as Jesus looks at Jerusalem and he sees its coming destruction, what does he do? He weeps over it. Because this is the God who takes no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but that the wicked turn from his way and live. Andrew Bonar says, I think that the shower of fire and brimstone was wet with the tears of God as it fell. And Jesus is nailed to a cross. And he prays, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do. Because this is the God whose first thought is not to condemn, but to save, and who meets the whole cost of saving sinners himself. And you see, we could go on and on and on. The God who David runs to is the Lord, is Yahweh, is Jesus. Who is this God? He's the God who turns sorrow to joy, who gives to us the new wine of his joy. This is the God who satisfies our souls with his very life. This is the God who the wicked will not find an easy touch. This is the God who stills the storms that threaten to destroy our lives. And this is the God who is long-suffering with the wicked, but will ensure that justice is done. And this is the God who is ready to save all who call upon him. Now, says David, given my choice to take things into my own hands, or to fall upon his kind hands, which should I do? So you know my answer. In the Lord I put my trust. How can you say to my soul, flee as a bird to your mountain? My friend, do you know this God? Do you know the Lord? Is everything shaking and falling apart? Are you going to run away? Or are you going to run to him? As we close this point, maybe you're thinking, well then, is it ever right to run somewhere to seek a place of safety? He's saying it's never right to escape a place of danger. No, we're not saying that, because Jesus himself said to his people, Matthew 10 verse 23, when they persecute you in this city, flee to another. He says, live to fight another day. It's not wrong to flee. There are occasions when it's right to get out of the way of danger. But the problem here, you see, is that these voices are saying, never mind the will of God, David. Never mind what God might be doing. You've got to save yourself. You've wasted long enough waiting for God to do something. You've got to take things into your own hands. It's an unbelieving voice. And David says, I'm not listening to it. I'm not listening to it. How can you say that to me? I'm not listening to what you're saying, because I've put my trust in the Lord. Or point number three. The king is in residence. Okay, David, you put your trust in the Lord. But Saul's still there, isn't he? They're still lying in ambush. And David, it's chaos. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? Okay, put your trust in the Lord. Is that really going to change anything, David? So what's David's response? Look at verse 4. The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. David says, you're looking at the problem. You're looking at the men. You're looking at those who are bending their bow. You're looking at those who are after me. I'm not looking at them. I'm looking somewhere else. My eyes are on the Lord. And as I look at the Lord, is he panicking? Have these convulsions unsettled him? Will King Saul have the last word? Oh, says David, it's unthinkable. The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. David says, my response to you is the king is in residence. He sits upon the throne. Not Saul who's calling the shots. The Lord rules. He's the king of heaven. And I know his authority is unchallengeable. His sovereignty is incontestable. He's the absolute Lord of all. And far from doing nothing, verse 4, his eyes behold. He's watching everything. He's watching every move. Verse 4, his eyelids test the sons of men. All our eyelids test people from time to time, don't they? Yeah, if you're scrutinizing somebody, what do? You lower your eyelids, don't you? Yeah, we all look at people, look at a situation like we're scrutinizing it. We lower our eyelids. Our eyelids are testing something. That's the sense of it. So far from God doing nothing, he's scrutinizing every situation. His eyelids test the sons of men. I'm watching you, Saul. And David, I've seen you. Don't panic. Don't do a runner. I know. Little boy was singing, trust and obey, for there's no other way to be happy in Jesus but to trust and obey. Only he was singing, trust and okay. Well, that's good theology, isn't it? Christian friend, if everything is falling apart, trust and okay. The Lord reigns. It's your Jesus who's upon the throne. So trust him. It's okay. It's okay. So David, what will God do? Well, verse 5. The Lord tests the righteous. Now, what does that mean? The Lord tests the righteous. I was rubbish at French. Voulez-vous répéter la question, s'il vous plaît? Is that the sort of test we're talking about? God's testing the righteous. You know, God sort of sets these impossible tests, which everyone's going to fail, and then God says, right, I thought you were like that, out you go. No, because the word translated test can also be translated try. The Lord tries the righteous. Well, what does that mean? Well, how do you purify gold? You try it, don't you? You try gold in the fire. You put it in the crucible, you turn up the heat, and what happens? The fire consumes the dross, but it doesn't damage the gold, does it? It just purifies the gold. The Apostle Peter put it like this. He says, in this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, you've been grieved by various trials. David's going through a trial, isn't he? You've been grieved by various trials. What's the point of this trial, or these trials? That the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to the praise, honour, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ. So what's going on in David's life? Well, the Lord's turned up the heat. Not to destroy his spiritual life, but to purify it. God's turned up the heat to burn off the dross, to purify the gold of his faith, so that when God looks at David, he can see his own reflection. Christian friend, the Lord's people have terrible troubles. And they don't get any easier, do they? In this life, God's people have terrible troubles. But whereas the unbeliever blames God, closes the door and walks away, Christian friend, we can't, can we? Like David, we can't walk out on God. We can't run away. What do when the trials come? In the Lord I put my trust. We run to him. And when the trials come and the heat's been turned up, what's going on? Far from walking out on the Lord, I find that Christ becomes more precious. And his cross becomes more wonderful to me. And instead of looking at the wind and the waves and thinking these are going to destroy me, I find myself walking on the water with Jesus. Christian friend, when everything falls apart, if the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? Maybe that's where you are tonight. It's all going wrong. Well, like David, I can say, in the Lord I put my trust. God's turned up the heat. It's not to destroy me. Nothing's gone wrong. The Lord reigns. He tests the righteous. He trains our trust. He purifies our faith. And he's fitting us for glory. But what about the souls of this world? What about the unbelieving? Well, look at verse 5. But the wicked and the one who loves violence, his soul hates. Upon the wicked he will rain coals, fire and brimstone, and a burning wind shall be the portion of their cup. Did you hear that? It's quite shocking, isn't it? Particularly verse 5. God doesn't just hate sin. What does it say? But the wicked and the one who loves violence, his soul hates. That's very strong, isn't it? It doesn't say God hates the sin and loves the sinner. It doesn't say that, but the wicked and the one who loves violence, his soul hates. Now, of course, hate to our ears has all sorts of connotations. People lose control. They scream, "I hate you." Hate is lethal in our hands, isn't it? It's like it becomes something bitter and twisted and murderous. But God is holy. God is different. God is maximally alive, which is why we're told, verse 5, he hates, and verse 7, he loves. It's saying God is not a slab of concrete. It's not like a sort of blob of jelly. He's not a sort of sentimental old man. He's not Reverend Jolly Boy who's just too polite to disagree with you. He's God. He's the Lord. He's Jesus. And there can be no peaceful coexistence between God and sin. And therefore, when God sees wickedness, when God sees violence, when he sees inhumanity, God recoils at it. It's in his very soul to recoil at it. But the wicked and the one who loves violence, his soul hates. It's in his very nature to recoil at those things. And therefore it's in his very nature to right the wrongs. And to vindicate those who have been sinned against. And to punish the perpetrators. So don't be squeamish about these things. Do you want Hitler to get away with it? Is that all right? Hitler get away with it? Or when Pol Pot murders over 2 million of his own countrymen, do you want God to sort of shrug his shoulders and say, "Well, c'est la vie, that's the way it goes"? When the wicked and those who love violence, so when the Nazis, when they industrialize murder, and you have gas chambers and concentration camps, do you want God to say, "Well, it's not my problem"? And when terrorists rain down fire upon others, do you expect there to be no comeback? Should the perpetrators of violent deaths themselves avoid a violent death? Is that the God that we want? God says there's a judgment where the guilty are condemned, where the wicked will be punished. My character, my very soul, guarantees it. I'm the God who draws the line. I'm the God who says, enough. Upon the wicked he will rain coals, fire and brimstone, and burning wind shall be the portion of their cup. Says God, I give sinners who won't repent, who refuse to turn to me, I give them what they deserve. They'll be crushed under an avalanche of my wrath. That's their portion. That's what they deserve. Who'd want to be Saul? Well, my friend, that puts us all on the spot, doesn't it? Yeah? The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. His eyes behold, his eyes test the sons of men. So if God is looking at us all, if God is scrutinizing all our lives, what does he see in my life? He sees a bit of violence in my life, doesn't he? Yeah? I've certainly done violence to his commands. I break those commands every day. I break them with a force. I don't love God with all my heart. I don't love my neighbour as myself. I do a lot of violence to my neighbour. You think about it. If all your thoughts towards your neighbour, if all your words towards your neighbour could be translated into action, you think of the violence that would be done. You think of the broken bones and the bleeding heads and the murders that would be perpetrated by us every day. So if great sinners shouldn't be allowed to get away with it, why should I be allowed to get away with it? When I look at a psalm like this, I realize I too am walking a path upon which God's anger is to be found. So aren't you glad now to hear of the Lord, of the Jesus, who takes no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but that the wicked would turn from his wicked ways. Come back to me, says God. Aren't you pleased? Aren't you relieved to learn of the God whose first thought is not to condemn us, but to save us? Who goes to a cross and dies that punishing death the sinners deserve to die. To bear in his body and soul the anger of God so that it burns itself out in him. so that all who run to him, all who put their trust in him, can enjoy peace with God and life everlasting. I was reading about a missionary who took this good news of Jesus Christ, took it to a people who had never heard the gospel ever before. And a woman was converted. She was saved. She found forgiveness of sins, life everlasting, a new life, a new beginning. She found Jesus. But this is what she said. She said, "I wish I'd heard this good news earlier, because I've killed 19 of my own children. Great violence, great wickedness. But she found forgiveness with Jesus Christ and a new beginning. That's the God that he is." So my friend, this evening, maybe it's time to turn the heat up on yourself a bit, isn't it? If God's looking at us, time to take a look at yourself. If God is his eyelids test the sons of men, maybe it's time I scrutinized myself. Yeah? Lower your eyelids, look at your life, look at your heart, look at your motives, your thoughts, your words, your deeds. Maybe ask you to see that I'm condemned and lost and guilty. Maybe I'm in danger of hellfire. And therefore I need to come to Jesus Christ. I need to be forgiven. I need to fall upon his kind arms. God, be merciful to me, the sinner. In the Lord I put my trust. Well, we close very, very briefly with our final point, which really, verse 7, is the conclusion to the matter. How does this psalm end? Verse 7, "For the Lord is righteous. The Lord loves righteousness. His countenance, his face, beholds the upright." Which can also be translated, "The upright behold his face." So God is looking at the upright. He's looking at his people. But it can also be translated, his people are also looking on the face of God. So, Christian friend, when everything is falling apart, when all is dark, when all I seem to be doing is dodging arrows, says the psalmist, don't despair. Don't do a runner. Don't think, I've got to take things into my own hands. I can't leave this with God. Look to him. And if through the dark clouds you can't see him smiling at you, beholding you in love, then says the psalmist, the day is coming, one day soon, and you'll awake in his likeness. And one bright morning, you'll open your eyes to see his face.